Welcome to season four of The Culture of Kindness. My name is Nahala Summers and I am your host. A culture of kindness is based on the idea that by bringing kindness into leadership, we reduce stress, anxiety, make happier workplaces, and in turn, improve the bottom line for any organization or institution. It is a book, leadership program, accreditation, and of course, this wonderful podcast. Kindness has been my life's work since I founded the social movement for kindness back in 2012 called Sunshine People. And it has kept me interested on what people have to say on the complexities of kindness ever since. The guest lineup is exceptional, from politicians to social media influencers, best-selling authors to BBC presenters, an eclectic mix of people who all have completely different views on kindness, how we get it, and where the world is currently at. If you enjoy this episode, then please do show your support for kindness by subscribing to the podcast, leave a five-star review, or simply invest in the book, aptly named A Culture of Kindness, available on Amazon. Thanks so much. I hope you enjoy. Claire, thank you so much for coming on and being a guest on A Culture of Kindness podcast. I have been looking forward to this podcast because you represent everything that I have a particular passion, interest, not to the extent that you do, but I do have a particular interest in it. And before I go on waffling about what you do, please do share a little bit about your life, your work, and how you got your interest in what you do.
Well, firstly, thank you so much for inviting me on. I've been really looking forward to this conversation too, as I know you share a lot of the similar interests with me. And having read your work, I'm really keen to get into some of the themes that we both share. So thank you so much. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I am an author and an academic, and at present I'm living in Denmark, where I'm a Marie Sklodowska Curie Fellow funded by the European Commission. And I work on empathy and international security and diplomacy and political leadership and society. I'm interested in how we experience empathy, but critically, what it means for politics and also how empathy is in itself political. And it's been a journey that has taken me through a PhD. My PhD was on empathy and diplomacy. And then I did a postdoc at Yale, the Henry A. Kissinger Postdoctoral Fellowship there, where I developed the ideas of my thesis, and which I'm now turning into a book. And I also worked before I did my doctoral degree in Parliament and in Chatham House in London, where I worked on defence and international security. So I like to think that my work can bridge both academia and policy and can have relevance to our everyday lives.
I mean, anybody listening to this, particularly right at this present time, I mean, actually, in a lifetime, I guess, would say empathy is so far from the political arena in so many ways, not in, for every politician, that would be unfair, but the ones that we're seeing all the time, have you found that within your work? Is your work about understanding, does it exist in it, or is the work mostly around how, if we put empathy into the mix, then we start to see positive or negative change from that?
So it's both, actually, because working in politics as I did and policy for 7 years, I found that actually a lot of people really get the ideas behind my work. And actually at that point, it wasn't my work. I just found that a lot of people were empathetic. I mean, politicians have a very bad reputation, but the majority of them are in because they care about issues and they care about their constituents. They care about the people they serve and the vision that they have for society. And we might disagree with their vision and we might find that they miss really crucial parts. But the majority of people in it, I think, do it for a public service. But then it's not always valued. It's not always something we see at the forefront. It's not something that is maybe easy to demonstrate when you get into the machinations and the systems of politics. You're maybe not rewarded for being empathetic because of the systems that we're working in. So I'm interested in, how does empathy exist in politics, in diplomacy, in security? How has it always been present? And in my research, I show that there are debates about the importance of empathy going back decades. That, you know, after the First World War, and when you get as well to the foundation of the United Nations, these ideas are integral to how we reimagine society after conflict. But then how do they get lost? What are the limitations to them? Why do we not do better at it? And then I also want to do that second piece that you spoke about, which is then, how can us embracing empathy and the power and the strength of empathy make this system better? How do we use it to create better politics, to create a more inclusive dialogue, to bring about better diplomacy and a more conducive environment to dialogue and understanding? So it's both of them, really. And so I also do interrogate the limitations and when empathy can also be problematic, because it can be problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. You've done some incredible work, which you publish and is out there, and we'll talk about the books in a moment. But I kind of touched on this before we jumped on to the episode, but in 2019, you did a paper with Barbara Keys, an article with Barbara Keys as well. And one of the questions that you were answering that I just thought was epic, and I want to know what came from it, is, you know, it said, do diplomats consciously experience feelings on behalf of the state? And if so, how? Now, that's huge, you know, because actually the world through the media, and I'm glad that you said, you know, politicians do are in the whole have that empathy, because I think what we see is a media driven story that says they don't get what's going on. And I think there's probably two sides. But this question says, actually, do they really feel it, the things that go on? What came out from that?
Oh, it's a great question. And yes, I loved working on that paper. I was really fortunate to work with Professor Keys. She's a brilliant historian, and it's part of a dialogue that we had and that I think is ongoing. Both of our work are interested in how emotions play a role in diplomacy and what does that mean. And we were talking about it, and we sensed that there was this duality that exists where diplomats are both individuals who have emotions. And we want to imagine that people in positions of power are entirely rational. And we have this very sterile idea within our popular discourse that rationality is something to be revered and it's devoid of emotion. But actually, you can't separate emotion and reason. And neuroscientists, behavioral scientists, psychologists will tell you this. And so we're like, we wanted to question, what does that mean then for how diplomats go about their business? What do they do? And they are simultaneously individuals with emotions who are dealing with their own personal encounters with another in their diplomatic space. But at the same time, diplomats are hugely professional, and they're very conscious of the norms and the rules and the conventions of their role. And in their role, they are agents of the state. They are there to pursue the interests and the objectives of the country that they represent. And so in that sense, they have to embody the interests and the identity of the state that they are representing. But what we discussed in that paper was also that the personal dimensions of your own emotions will always be there. You can't ever entirely separate them from you. And they provide a lens. So in the paper, we use the example again of Dr. Henry Kissinger, who is known for his pride and for his ego, and he confronts the Chinese prime minister at the time, the premier, Zhou Enlai. And Zhou Enlai is a very urbane, very intellectual, hugely kind of competent professional. and feels a certain sense of insecurity that comes out in some of the archives. And so he's trying to present America and represent America, but is also conscious of his own kind of individual experience of that moment. And so that's what we wanted to do, that to show that at the kind of critical point, everybody is human and they're not automatons just out there representing the state. And a lot of them are very good at reading their emotions and their emotional state and knowing what that does to their judgment. But it's always going to be a subjective and variable process.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. I want to go through all of your research, but I don't think I'm going to have time. I'm looking at going, oh, I want to know more about that. But you wrote your latest piece. Well, I imagine it's your latest piece because it was 2020, apart from the books. But the policy report. Now, is that something that has come off the back of it, that you've written policy based on this? Because you're talking about here about making the connection, the role of empathy in communicating policy. Share a little bit, if you will, about what that kind of looked like, but also you did some case studies, and I'd be really interested to, and I think the listeners would be really interested to understand what came out from those case studies that you did.
So one of the core areas I focus on in my work is the idea of how we communicate matters. The words we use, the behaviors that we signal our intent with, the way we treat others is hugely important in the policy space. And so what does that mean for policy, about how policy is framed and communicated, and especially about how those people in positions of power connect with audiences? Because empathy is such a critical component in human connection. It says to the audience, we see you, we hear you, you matter, you are important, we're taking on board your concerns and your interests. And that's so important. And I actually wrote a piece a few years ago on strategic communications and empathy in strategic communications. And the policy report you mentioned, Making the Connection, builds on that. And I really wanted to make the case that we have to have a far greater appreciation for the value of empathy in how we communicate policy. And it's not just about hitting send on a message, we've got this new policy idea, here you go. It's about saying, we've thought about what you need and what we think matters. We've incorporated that into the policy process, and then we're going to communicate what the implications of that are. And it shouldn't just be, like I said, this hit send process. It should be part of an iterative and continuous process where governments are in dialogue with citizens, and that we have this constant conversation that exists, where it's not just some people setting the agenda and the public make do, but that government is much more responsive. So communication takes on a broad definition in that sense. It's not just what we say, it's part of a process of communicating. And I use these case studies, which were New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern after the Christchurch terrorist attacks, because I just think she's such a fascinating model of empathetic communication. And she really dealt with that well by taking a moment of crisis and using empathy and compassion and awareness of the situation of herself and how she would be seen as a representative in trying to diffuse the tensions that might arise after a terrorist attack following the Christchurch attack, and how she used it as an opportunity to bring unity after that crisis. Because often after terrorist attacks in recent years, we've seen a rise in hate crimes against Muslim communities or against Jewish communities, which further exacerbates the kind of divisions within society and undermines the cohesion that makes for more prosperous societies. The second case study was German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the way in which she opened the doors of Germany to refugees after the tragic incidents of Alan Kurdi, who was washed up on a beach in Turkey. And she said, we have this imperative to help. And especially as Germans, we know what it feels like to experience tragedy, and we need to help the people who are fleeing war and conflict and insecurity. And with that case, I wanted to demonstrate the politics as well of empathy, because whereas Prime Minister Ardern is often praised for her approach, Angela Merkel was criticized because although initially there was this boost and this sense of good feeling, other leaders in Europe started to say, well, we can't take in all these people. There are other implications that come with your decision. And we're worried about domestic populations. We're worried about perceptions of security threats that people are voicing. And especially on the far right, they're causing problems in a number of countries. And so European leaders were a bit more cynical about this. They're a bit less willing to go with her approach. And so I wanted to explore the politics that actually empathy isn't always palatable to people. It's very uncomfortable. And then the final case study was the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, and the kind of lack of empathy that I felt had been exhibited after the Grenfell crisis, where she was trying to be very, very professional and very calm and a kind of voice of reason, but actually what people wanted at the time was emotion. And so the expectations that were around it. And it was actually by accident, but all three were women. I think I could have done similar with President Obama or, you know, looking at other leaders from various countries, maybe Prime Minister Trudeau and others, and explored ways in which they'd used empathy to communicate policy. But I think it's telling that these three women really stood out.
It is, yes. And it's also interesting. I mean, you talk about Barack Obama there, and I can always remember when, and I cannot remember the exact shooting. There have been too many, might be in Sandy Hook. And he got on the podium and spoke to people and said, you could tell he was feeling it. Like as he spoke, he was really feeling it. There was no kind of faking it. He was honest. He said, my hands are tied. I don't actually have control over this because I keep trying to stop it and I keep getting voted against. And it was honesty, it was integrity. And he stood there and said it. And I think you always remember those moments, don't you, where politicians, somebody in politics has stood up and been hand on heart, empathetic, stood in the shoes of somebody else that they do not, that they don't understand normally, but that they have thought, how would I feel? You know, it's interesting, as you talked about those, I thought, and I was thinking about them all, and I'm sure some of the listeners would agree, you know, when I think about Jacinta in New Zealand, as though I know her, you know, first name, please. as I think about her, I think it came across as there was no political agenda. It wasn't as though there was a reason to do it, other than it was the right thing to do. Mm. It was how she felt she needed to react. And and I think certainly in the UK, we have people in positions of power, and not to talk badly of Theresa May, but who are very disconnected from boots on the ground and have never really understood that and have not been able to stand in the shoes of every person that they represent in the country to say, how would I feel? And it seems like you picked that up. What did you look at kind of consequence of it in terms of what happened off the back of those kind of poor communications and the impact and how severely that impacted the countries?
So in the report, I didn't, because it was quite a short piece. Mm. But in the book that I'm writing on political leadership, that will be much more part of the analysis, this idea of what happens when we encounter brilliantly empathetic leaders, but also when we feel it's missing. And what does that mean? And one of the areas that I'm particularly concerned about is the implications of poor leadership for trust and for public trust, and for not only how we trust politicians, but how we trust each other. Because those who sow divides within society weaken society as a whole, and the communities are weakened. It isn't just something that happens in Westminster or DC or Paris. It's something that we feel in our communities. And that's really something I want to go into in much detail, more detail in the work that I'm doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. It leads us very nicely onto your books. But also I will say, you know, as you will have read, the erosion of trust is probably what, for me, something that I would say it's its very own pandemic of issue, you know, because the trust it's not getting any better. It's just continuing to kind of destroy itself, really. And I get more and more concerned by that. You know, anybody that's in politics is not really trusted in their opinions or, you know, their conversation. You know, whenever they're talking now, everyone's like, well, I don't really believe that. And that stands to be a problem, I think. You know, there seems to be... there has to be an element that the media kind of drums that up as well, because there's a lot of things that go on, and in every house, in every country, in every political situation, in every country, but we don't see that, you know, the people in the public eye don't see that, I guess.
I mean, I think on this, I would love to see us value politics more, because we've seen through the pandemic, it's really revealed quite how politics affects every part of our lives. Mm. And often we view it as something that isn't our business, or it's not part of our concerns, it's something remote. And it's something we have to care about, and we have to take it more seriously, and we have to engage in it far more critically and constructively, but also in a more empowered way. We have to get involved to make things better. And I think it starts at a local level, just being conscious of how politics touches our lives. And I think if we start to do that, then we will have a greater process of accountability for those in charge. That there will be more of a sense of, like I said before, dialogue between the public and the politicians, because we will demand it and expect it, and they will know that comes with it. And that's not, you can't just sit in this, in the Houses of Parliament or in Congress or wherever, and make legislation without thinking about the impact on people. But we have to say what the impact is. We have to be involved and engaged. And I do think there's also a conversation about what we expect from the media and the quality of news that we get. And it's fascinating when I look at the archives from the 1920s and 1930s. They had such detailed news stories. I mean, the print is tiny. I think you'd need glasses very soon after you started reading them, but it's so in depth. And I would find, for example, government officials in America putting whole explanations for a policy on the front page of the New York Times, you know, that this was valued as something that you explain to the people. And the problem now is that we've got into this cycle where it's about sound bites. It's about, does it bleed? Then it leads. You know, how do we make it catchy? How do we monetize the news? How do we make it so that people click? And we have to have a much more nuanced debate about what do we need from our news? And it has to be balanced, and it has to be fair and detailed. And we have to allow that there will be differences of opinions, and there will be editorials and different commentators who offer different perspectives. And that's important. But we have to move away from the misinformation, the disinformation, reducing a complex issue to a soundbite, because we do very difficult, challenging issues a disservice when we do that. Mm. And part of being in a democracy is exactly this idea of dialogue. It is a dialogue. We have to get more comfortable with compromise, with not getting everything we want, and understanding that there are different perspectives out there. And one way we see that is through the media, is by seeing that the media reflects back different experiences.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, you know, our involvement. And we talk about the idea, well, we can vote. But certainly within the education I was provided in the UK, we never learned about how politics worked, how Westminster worked. It wasn't something that was in kind of our mainstream education. And so really, if you wanted to learn about that, same as psychology, you know, same as understanding how our brains work, which is quite important to understand when you're actually quite young, because then you can manage your emotions, right? You understand why. And it's the same with that political conversation. But you only really learn about that in the UK, and that may have changed because it was a little while ago I went to school. Not that long ago, but a little while. And then you chose that to study. And of course, who wants to study politics? You know, it's a very specialist thing. You know, I don't remember anyone from my school year going into politics and learning about it, because you didn't get any kind of taster of it, really, and what that might look like, unless you had dreams to be the prime minister, of course. And it's interesting that you talk about that media, you know, the change, the front cover, having a whole policy written on there. You know, we could only dream, right? And you really have to kind of dig deep to find out what the policy changes are, or you have to really start to get very heavily involved. It's not kind of up all the time. And I go into social media and see, you know, a campaign saying, you know, they've changed the laws and not really consulted with us, and it's been approved. And, you know, everyone feels very, very powerless. And I'm not sure if that's a story that's being just put around because we can't trust what we're being told, as you talk about that lack of trust, or whether it is actually valid and things are going on, we'll make noise over here and then we'll get this approved over here. Through Parliament. And we've eroded the trust so much so that we now don't know what the truth is when people do actually really say it. And I find that a little scary, really. And maybe there's the education around how do we make a difference within politics, because it feels like we're very powerless at the moment.
Yes, you're right. When I was at school as well, politics was an A-level, and that was it. And our knowledge of it when we were younger was so minimal. And I grew up in the northwest of the UK during kind of Thatcher and then Major years. And I just remember it feeling so removed from my experience. It was a language that I didn't understand. And it was something that I didn't feel really touched my life. And that's such an error on my part, because it really does. And what I'm very inspired by is how many young people are mobilizing and informing themselves and educating themselves. If we look at the real changes and the real shakeups in society right now, so many of them are led by really inspiring young people who say, we want a different future. We want things to be different. And whether that's on building community dialogue in their local area, or it's about climate change, or it's about misinformation, or just providing more support and care to their communities. You know, we're seeing this kind of self-education that is very exciting, but for too many reasons, I think politics itself remains quite dry. You know, this idea of first readings and second readings and amendments, you know, we need to have a much greater sense of literacy around what that means and at what stage interventions are most effective and how we inform that process. And whenever I spoke to people in Parliament, many people who are in the local area, if they meet with their MP, will speak positively of their MP because they will have surgeries, they can go and talk to their MPs, they can discuss the issues that are bothering them, and the MP's office will then help them. And obviously this is in a UK context that this happened, that my experience is from. But then it's when you get to the national level that people don't really understand what politicians do. And in the UK, you've got this very adversarial chamber, which pits people against each other in a very kind of direct way. Whereas now, where I am in Denmark, the conversation is more consensual, more kind of consensus-based. The room itself is not in opposition. People are not in opposition to one another. It's much more of a horseshoe sense. It's more in the round. It therefore fosters a greater sense of inclusion and dialogue and compromise and discussion. So I think we need to be talking about what we want politics to look like going forward, especially because right now it does seem like politics is having some trouble in the UK and in other countries as well, that people are disengaging and that it's not working as it should. We're not being represented in the most effective ways that we could be.
No, you're absolutely right. And I've talked about this probably on this podcast, I suspect, but you know, we have, it's as old as time. You know, they stand on opposite sides of the room and say, no, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. And there's nowhere to go. There's no conflict resolution. There's no working through things. And that for me says we miss that whole empathy piece altogether. Mm-hmm. And then not just in politics, but as we see it and we grow up with it, that's what we think. Well, that's how we resolve issues, right? But one of the things, I mean, you talked there about something interesting about the way that there's these kind of pockets of people who are ultimately uprising, really. And I've seen that. I've seen it in the media, in small pockets of media, in areas that are saying, we want to speak the truth. And we want to share what's going on factually. You know, we're not going to sensationalize things. We're not going to say, you know, if it bleeds, it works as a story. You know, we're just going to tell things how they are. And people want a joining up with that to say, yes, we want more of that. And I had a conversation with one of my very dear friends yesterday, and we were talking about the idea of, you know, where is the world going, as you do, you know, that sort of heavy conversation on a Wednesday night. And we were sharing about, and she said something really wonderful to me. She said, your parents' generation will not be as enlightened as you are. And then your children will be even more enlightened again as we start to learn more about ourselves. We will become more empathetic. We will start to grow all of these values. You know, we never had a conversation about mental health before, and now everybody's a little bit more aware. People are more aware of meditation and the importance of breath. You know, we're becoming more enlightened all the time. And so even though we could look at all the challenges that there are within driving empathy, within driving trust, I do feel that we've got a generation coming up, not far behind me, because I'm not that old, but the generation that's coming up seem to be in a position to drive that change and say, actually, we're not going to accept this. You know, we're not going to set the old ways of the system. Do you feel that from kind of generally looking at your research overall, not necessarily one piece, but do you feel that, I guess, is the question?
I think there's a huge amount that's troubling right now. Like you said, the state of the world. And I think a lot of us have found the last few years quite challenging because of the uncertainty and the insecurity that has accompanied the pandemic and all the other things that have come at the same time, is it really? But I also think there's a huge amount of hope in that. And I do think there's a lot that's very positive with this desire that is really growing to say, the system doesn't work. It can't be right that you have, like the Oxfam report just recently published, that you have the 10 richest men getting richer while the rest of the world is getting poorer, that you have this divide in wealth, that you have systems that reward people disproportionately for their effort and for their involvement and for their work. And that there is this real sense of we can only address the challenges that we face, whether that's health crises or climate change or the flows of people trying to escape insecurity and conflict, we can only address them if we work together. And so I am really encouraged by how many people are saying, we need to do things differently, that this can't go on. We can't keep on perpetuating these same problems and these same inequalities and injustices. We really have to rethink the system. And that's a difficult conversation to have. And it makes a lot of people uncomfortable because we find comfort in what we know. And yeah. When you have people saying we need to do things differently, then it leads to a lot of uncertainty about what that looks like. Mm. And I want to go back to the point you mentioned a little earlier as well, because I actually think conflict is inherent in human societies. And I don't mean conflict as in war or violence, but I think it's natural that we do disagree with different people. We all come from our own different backgrounds. We have our own experiences. We are going to come into tension with other people. What matters, and this is where I think your work as well is important, is that we deal with that conflict kindly. And that's where empathy comes in, that I understand you disagree, but I'm going to have this conversation with you kindly. We can disagree. And I found most people, I love talking politics, probably too much, but I also love having those debates with people where you come at an angle very differently. And my friends will often say, let's explore what it is we don't like about this idea. Like, how is it confronting us? Yeah. And you dig into that. And I found most people, when you say, I respectfully disagree with you, and this is why, they also respect that. And they know that you're not going to convert them and convince them. But within that space, you find a sense of shared humanity. You understand you both have dignity as individuals. And there will be things in that that you disagree on, but there'll also be a lot that you find you have in common, that actually you're coming at it from a different point of view, but you both want security, or you both want the best for your family or for your friends, and you both just want to make sure that you have the same opportunities or that certain things are available to you. And that's what I think we need to maintain as we embrace this change, is we have to make sure that we can disagree respectfully and kindly and with empathy. And I always say that, and I know Brené Brown also talks about this a lot, you can't have empathy without boundaries. And I think being able to say, this is unacceptable to me, you know, I will not tolerate racism or xenophobia or sexism or homophobia or, you know, anything that denies the right of someone else's identity is not okay in a conversation with me. But if you want to talk about other issues, then let's discuss that. Let's have a conversation. And I think it's the only way through. We have to embrace the conflict, but do so kindly.
Yes, absolutely. I feel like we're probably going into a double episode. I don't know. I'm going to leave it up to the experts to decide that, who do all the background work and all the important stuff. I want to touch on your books, because you've got a new book that you're working on, but you have actually got a new theory and practice of diplomacy and new perspectives. It looks like you've got two, contemporary diplomacy, but do you want to just share a little bit about that and what that work looked like?
Yeah, so last year, these two books were published. They're two volumes and they're related, but they're different and distinct. And again, I'm so lucky with my co-authors. I always get to work with such brilliant people, but I got to work with Professor Jack Spence and Dr. Alistair Masser from King's College. We were co-editors on these volumes. And they just contain some brilliant articles by colleagues and academics and practitioners who share their experience and expertise on diplomacy. And we wanted with these books to really say, we don't value diplomacy enough, and this is how it informs so many different parts of our lives. We need to understand how it's changing. We need to understand how different people approach it and what matters. And so it's quite an eclectic mix of essays, but it was such an exciting process because the people we worked with are just doing some fascinating original work and really putting forward their ideas very clearly, very eloquently, in a way that hopefully is accessible primarily to academics and students of diplomacy, but also hopefully we've tried to make sure that they're accessible to a wider public who are interested in diplomacy. Because we do need to really harness its potential to address, like I said earlier, these collective challenges we face. We can't do climate change. We can't address the potential of technology and artificial intelligence to change our worlds without diplomacy. We're seeing right now conflict and tensions at the borders between Russia and Ukraine. You know, all of this needs diplomacy. So what does that look like today, and how can we be prepared for the future? So yeah, they were published last year with Bloomsbury and IB Taurus. So we're really excited to see them out. They're a long time in the process.
Amazing, amazing. And you've got a new book that's going to be coming out, or you're in the process of writing at the moment. What will that look like?
So I'm actually writing two at the moment, which is maybe not the wisest of ideas, but the one I'm writing is Empathy and Diplomacy. So I'm really looking at the role of empathy in this space. What does it mean? How does it work? What are the limitations and the obstacles to it? How has it existed in the past? How have people thought about it and spoken about it? And what does it mean for our future? And again, echoing some of the themes that we've discussed here, how do we have a more empathetic diplomacy? What does that look like? And I was lucky enough, and have been lucky enough, to speak to diplomats from various countries around the world who shared their insights and their expertise, to really ask them, what does this mean for you? And then also look at what it means beyond that, beyond the kind of private negotiations that take place. So that is with Brookings Institution and Chatham House Press. So that should be out hopefully later this year, depending on how everything goes. And then the other book is on empathy and political leadership. Both books will have better titles that are more I'm not going to give away their titles just yet. But and the second book is with Yale University Press. And that is really about what does it mean for politics and for how people lead, for what we expect of our leaders, and for the kind of political culture and society we want to have. Yeah. So I'm excited about both. And I hope they both speak to one another in many ways and many of the topics.
Yeah, I will definitely be reading that and be fascinated. There is something, you know, as you were talking there, and I was thinking about also about that understanding of even to do with the positioning. I think you talked about Denmark, and it's a kind of a circular conversation, isn't it? People are sat in a circle when they're talking, whereas we sit on one side and the other. I mean, even those simple things, changing the way that debates happen in the positioning of everybody, and these tiny things, it's not tiny, it'd be changing an entire building, but you know, it's small things that starts to change how empathetic we can be and how we deal with conflict and how we speak to each other rather than point of view. It is fascinating. I mean, you can, yeah, it's it'll be wonderful to read your book. I'm interested in where it sits. How do we drive more of it? Can we do more, you know, to drive empathy into politics? You know, because otherwise all we're doing is saying you need to be more empathetic, but how can we as people drive more empathy within our politics? And there's something fascinating about that too, right?
That's exactly core to my argument. We all need to be better at doing politics, and we all need to be better at creating the environment and the culture we want from politics and from our politicians. And I think it's so interesting to look at the really varied and rich work on empathy and organizational cultures, but we don't always apply that to politics. So there's a lot about how leaders can affect change within organizations and managers can become more empathetic. But I think similar principles apply to how we do politics. And it's a two-way, or maybe it's a multi-way process where it comes from many different directions. It's not just top-down. It's because we start to create expectations of change and of better behavior. And I think one of the organizations doing that in the UK at the moment is Compassion in Politics, who are really saying we can do politics better. We can bring more compassion and more caring to our politics. And I think it's an exciting conversation to be in. And I am encouraged that despite the challenges we face, people are really wanting to see it be better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'll be looking them up as well. Claire, thank you so much for your time. I'm ever so grateful. You can find out more about Claire at claireyorke.me, and of course your books and get them there. I always end on the final question, which I'm sure that I think to myself, are people bored with this question? But I don't think people are, because I've never had the same answer twice. You know, everybody always says something completely different. I don't know how it's possible after so many episodes of this. But what does a culture of kindness mean to you?
What a great question. And what I loved when I was reading your book was that you, like me, also take on this idea that kindness and empathy can mean different things to different people. And so I really love the idea that it depends on where we sit and what we're looking for. But if I were to summarize it very briefly, I think a culture of kindness is one that is imbued with authentic care, where we think about what is best for the people around us. And that best might be subjective. It might not always be saying what people want to hear. Actually, I think it's far kinder to be honest where you have to be honest. But I think where your modus operandi and your ethos is to authentically care for others and to have that relationship with yourself and the community, where care and kindness are at the heart of it.
Amazing. What an amazing answer. Thank you so much. I didn't expect anything else, but thank you so much, Claire. I really appreciate your time. People know where they can look you up. It'll be on the details as well. Thanks so much again.
Oh, it's lovely to join you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have loved this episode, please do share it with others. Pop on and give a lovely review, but mostly take forwards into your life something that can change someone else's. We are looking for the elusive happiness, and kindness is the action that can get us there.